Hey, well, good morning, everybody. Good to see you. And if you've got a Bible with you or you have a Bible app on your phone, you might want to turn to Luke chapter 6. And we're going to carry on in Luke 6, 37 to 42. In fact, while you're finding that, I'll just read you the passage. Do not judge, you'll not be judged. Do not condemn, you'll not be condemned. Forgive, and you will be forgiven. Give and it will be given to you. A good measure, pressed down, shaken together and running over, will be poured into your lap. For the measure you use, it will be measured to you. He also told them this parable. Can a blind man lead a blind man? Will they not both fall into a pit? A student's not above his teacher, but everyone who's fully trained will be like his teacher. Why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank that's in your own eye? How can you say to your brother, "Brother, let me take the speck out of your eye," when you yourself fail to see there's a plank in your own eye? You hypocrite, first take the plank out of your eye, then you will see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye. Last week, I spoke from the first verses. Do not judge, you'll not be judged. Don't condemn, you'll not be condemned. Forgive, and you'll be forgiven. And we finished that, give, and it will be given to you. And we finished in the context, well, I talked the whole time about this word, generosity, about having generous attitudes, of being people who have heart attitude that's generous. That if we're going to be a church community in this area, and I know I've used this phrase a number of times, and perhaps one or two people, it sounds a strange way of putting it, but if we're going to be accused of love, then heart attitudes, including being generous, is really, really vital. And that takes working through it, and it's a challenge at times to do that. But will we be people who respond in that way? And I finished this verse, give it and will be given to you. A good measure, pressed down, shaken together and running over, will be poured into your lap. For the measure you use, it will be measured to you. And we'll come back to that in just a moment. I guess in a few weeks' time, in December, if you got on the bus and you saw the driver, for example, wearing something like this, you'd be like, okay, yeah, okay. Maybe either Sinterklaas is coming up or they're doing it for Christmas. And you probably wouldn't say much, but you might think, slightly strange. But if you work for Arriva and you are in the recruitment team and a man or a woman showed up to their interview with this on their head, I wonder what you would think then. Would you think, I'm going to employ this person? They're clearly a competent bus driver. Of course, wearing a hat like this says nothing of whether they're a competent bus driver or not. I did actually have a pair of dodgy sunglasses you can't see through either, but somewhere between home and here, they went missing. Certainly if they were wearing those, you might question whether or not they'd be a good driver. It's so easy, so easy to fall into making judgments, even trivial ones, about other people. I was reminded of this last week when I was chatting to someone after in coffee time. It was nothing to do with them. It just prompted me. 2 weeks ago, I was in Manchester with our son, JJ, at a university open day. And we went to various meetings, various talks, and we went into one of them, and it was a lecture theatre where, you know, sloping lecture theatre we sat, and I looked down at the bottom, and near the big screens is a man in a suit. And my brain went like this. Oh, this looks formal. He looks boring. This is going to be dreadful. Just confession. It's good for the soul. You know? How wrong I was. It was not just one of the most informative university talks I've ever heard. It was about accommodation. Not a very exciting topic in theory. It was incredibly entertaining. He could have done it in 20 minutes. He took 40. But it was hilarious. And JJ and I were just cracking up with laughter a whole load of the time. But also the information went in. My judgment was so wrong. I wrote to him late in the week. I said, you were so good, I could have come again. I could have just spent the day going to the accommodation talk. Forget everything else. Because why? I'd made a judgment based on someone's appearance alone. And I was so proved wrong and delighted to have been proven wrong. Prophet Samuel is sent by the Lord to the house of a guy called Jesse to go and anoint one of the sons to be king of Israel to replace Saul. And the sons are brought in. And they're big, and they're handsome, and they're strapping, and they've been working out in the gym. They're the business. And Samuel's like, oh yeah, surely. Number one's brought in. His name's just gone out of my head. Beg his pardon. But he's brought in. Surely this is who God will want. And God's like, no. And these various sons are trotted through. And Samuel's like, oh, I thought you sent me here, Lord. Have you got anyone else, Jesse? I mean, is anyone in the cupboard or anything hiding under the stairs like a Harry Potter novel or something? I don't know. And it's, well, there's David. He's out in the fields looking after the sheep. Well, go and get him. And so this lad is brought back and the Lord's anointed him. Because Samuel, look, people look at the outward appearance, but God looks at the heart. Don't judge, you'll be judged. Don't condemn, you'll be condemned. Forgive and you'll be forgiven. Give and it will be given to you. Generous attitudes. As I said last week, every time I heard this verse being preached about when I was growing up, it was to do with financial giving, which can work when you lift the verse out of context. And it's not that I don't think it has anything it could say about financial giving, because it touches on generous attitudes. But actually the context is forgiving, not judging, not condemning. But that being said, I do just want to say something briefly, and I want to keep it brief because I want to get through to the rest of the passage, about giving. So one of the difficulties with this verse as we make this about financial giving and about our possessions and even our time and so on, is it can become very transactional. Give and it will be given to you. Oh, so if I give 10 euros, I'm going to get 10 euros back. Or based on this verse, if I give 10 euros, I'm going to get 50 euros back. That like giving to God is some sort of quick get rich scheme. It's the ultimate pyramid scheme with God at the top. That's the wrong way to see it. Now, I want to say that we've had occasions on top of our normal giving, we've given a gift to someone anonymously, and we've been given in the same day the same amount back. I don't think it was literally the same notes, but it's about. We've had occasions where we've given on a day and someone else has given us more. We've had days when we've given and no one's given anything. The point is, it doesn't matter. And the thing is, it can happen where you give and it's also given to you in a like kind. But that's not why we give. And it's not about a transaction in that sense. It's about our trusting of God. It's about our gratitude. It's about our love. It's about our responding to the prompting of his leading, not manipulation of other people. But are we going to be people who are generous with our time, with our skills, with our possessions, hospitality, with our finances? How's that going to be? And there's a couple of verses I just want to read quickly, and then we'll come back to the main text. It's from 2 Corinthians 9. I think this is a great guidance to help us. The context is a gift is being taken up through a lot of the churches in Asia Minor to help those who are in poverty situation because of famine. Each of you should give what you've decided in your heart to give, not reluctantly or under compulsion, for God loves a cheerful giver. I don't know if you always feel cheerful when your Ballasting Dietz purple envelope comes through the door. But you have to do it. Yeah, and quite rightly, we're told to pay our taxes. I mean, absolutely. But God loves a cheerful giver. And God is able to bless you abundantly so that in all things, at all times, having all that you need, you will abound in every good work. Just a couple of things I just want to throw out to us today. A cheerful giver. Not under compulsion, not manipulated, not reluctantly, but cheerful. It's about heart attitude. Because you see, sometimes we may feel a challenge in our heart to give sacrificially. And the thing is, with sacrificial giving, it's a sacrifice. It costs something. It might be, for example, we feel called to give into something, and so, I don't know, this might sound a trivial example, maybe not. We don't buy the top of the range phone so that we can give. We change our holiday plans so we can give. Or whatever it might be. And I'm not giving you a list right now of how you should spend your money. This is not the point of what I'm saying. But if we're cultivating our heart of openness to God, remember, it's love God and love others, and we allow that to actually impact our bank accounts, that can be quite radical. But the other thing I'll lift up from this is the second verse. God's able to bless you abundantly. Do we believe that? You see, because I want to suggest that all of us need a prayed through, thought through basis for our giving of our time, our skills, our hospitality, our possessions, our finances. And we spend time looking in scripture about it because, you know, Jesus actually had a lot to say about heart attitude, money, and possessions. In fact, dare I say this, he had more to say that than, for example, sexual morality. And yet some Christians love to go on about sexual morality. I'm not saying that's not an important topic, but they get ever so precious if you start talking about money. And some of that is probably because of manipulation and all kinds of stuff that goes on, and preachers who are saying, you know, put into my ministry and you'll be blessed and all this kind of stuff. And we've probably all had some of experience of the kind of prosperity gospel type stuff. I'm not here to advocate that. I don't see that in the Bible at all. But let's not go to the opposite extreme and miss the call to trust God. That actually, well, we sang it earlier, didn't we? It was very appropriate. I surrender all. Does that include your Rabobank account? Phew, I'm with ABN AMRO. Well, the church is, so anyway. Now, and I don't want to heavy us on this, but I just want to encourage us in the context of heart attitude, give and it to be given to you, to say, Lord, what are you showing me? Or if you're a couple, what are you showing us? Including about trusting you. And I could talk a lot about lots of personal stories on that, but I'm not going to right now because today's talk isn't supposed to be about finances. Or principally about that. But I just want to say something. And so, enjoying this little bit to the end, I just throw some questions out. And I can always send these out to Connect Group leaders as well. I didn't include them in the notes, but I can add them in. Why do we give? I'm not just talking about money, but our time, our skills, our prayers. Is our giving a response to God in love, gratitude, trust, and worship? Or is it duty, guilt, or superstition? If I don't tithe, God's going to get me. I used to be under that a little bit. Now, we still use tithing as a being basis of our giving, but it's not our superstition. I'm not going to get into all that topic today and tithing, but we're doing it out of duty, guilt, or superstition. It's good to be, if I think we can, organized and committed with our giving. But that's different than duty. Are we generous? Are we just generous people? Are we open-handed or closed-handed? And that links back to, are we trusting God? In our giving, Christians can be a bit bad at it sometimes, have we neglected our family or even ourselves? You know, it's okay to still look after your own family. You don't have to give to everybody else as well. And your own family has to be neglected. There's a balance. And lastly, there's a big question. We could spend half an hour or more on this. How can we give, but dare I also say it, spend in ways that are just, ethical, and expresses love to our neighbours? And that's one for us all to think about, of how do we work that out? Because you see, we could go on this, well, in order to give, I know where I can give. I will buy the cheapest products of everything possible. But some of those products might be incredibly unethical. Some of the clothes, for example, people might have been working in sweatshops and are basically being human trafficked to work into those things. And I know there's a massive challenge at times being able to find out what the truth is behind a product. And I get that. But part of our loving God, loving others, of our give and it will be given to you, is to embrace maybe the challenge, the difficulty of working through some of these things. Okay, let's come back to our Luke 6 passage. Keep an eye on the time. He also told them this parable. Can a blind man lead a blind man? Will they not both fall into a pit? A student is not above his teacher, but everyone who's fully trained will be like his teacher. One occasion, Jesus challenged some of the Pharisees with probably not the most friendly conversation, but Jesus saw into people's hearts. And one says, he says to them, "Woe to you, blind guides. You teachers of the law, you religious leaders, you spiritual people, you're blind." And here in this case, Jesus says, can a blind person lead a blind person? What, they both fall into the pit. And the context here is about discipleship. And the direct context here is not judging, not condemning, forgiving, and giving. And if we are judging, we are condemning, we are refusing to forgive, and we talked last week about some of the challenges about forgiveness. If we're not giving people, arguably we're blind. There certainly are blind spots in our lives, and there's all kinds of other ways we could apply that into our lives. It says a student is not above his teacher, in this case, her teacher, because I decided I'd put a girl and a guy up instead. Jesus is talking here about the process of a disciple learning from their rabbi, from their teacher, and that actually that journey which would take place. And so, again, if you like, in the context of what's written, we're called to not judge like Jesus didn't judge. We're called to not condemn like Jesus did not condemn. We're called to forgive like Jesus forgave. We're called to give like Jesus gave, which is challenging. There's no student is above their teacher, but they're called to be like their teacher, called to that kind of sacrificial giving. Jesus, who gave his all on the cross. So when we sang that song earlier, I Surrender All, which I sang, there was also part of me going, Lord, do I mean that in every area of my life? I surrender all? Or am I really singing, Lord, I surrender 72%? Doesn't scan, so the songwriters wouldn't like it. But maybe that's more truthful. And then I could get in judgment mode, which is going to get to the verses we're coming to. Well, at least I'm doing 72%. I reckon they're only 46. So, I'm doing better. No. And we don't have to go weird with it. And we also, it's okay to acknowledge, what does it really mean to love God with all our heart? Does that mean we've got to go around all day going, Jesus, 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 Jesus? And your colleagues are looking at you going, what are they on? I don't want it. You know, what do we? It is a challenge. I want to say to you, it's a challenge of walking that out. And that's why we need community. We need to help each other on that journey. What does loving God with all your heart look like for you, and learn from each other? And I think it's okay to do that, because otherwise it's just some nice rhetoric we say. And then in half an hour, well, less than half an hour, because we're going to have communion, we'll go to coffee time and then we go and do week again and going, oh yeah, love the God with all my heart, love my neighbour as myself. But what's it mean? Challenging words. Just go to the last verses as we approach towards communion. Underneath some of the seats, either right underneath you or near you, is an envelope. Could you pick up that envelope and open it carefully? Inside that envelope, you will find some rice grains. If you could take out a rice grain for yourself, and if your neighbor is rice grainless, give them one as well. There's new grammar, rice grainless. There we go. Sounds like a, I don't know, an exotic singer or something. Rice grainless in concert. So get your little rice grain and then hold it at your eye. Don't drop it in. Along with your contact lens, it might be lost forever. And the LOMC will have this line of people at the first aid thing going, I've got a piece of rice stuck in my eye. I went to church. Oh, no. I don't want that happening to you. That crazy preacher. So you got your rice grain? Yeah, get it there clear. Let me quote scripture to you. Here we go. Why do you look at the rice grain in your brother or sister's eye when there is a cooking pot full of rice in your own eye? You say, but that's not the actual verse. Yeah, I know. But there's a difficulty. Here's sawdust. I did not know how I was going to take this and put it into each individual envelope and you get it out. We picked this up in the wood the other day, but I do have a plank. Some people, I remember a lady telling me in our old church, I think it was an old church, it wasn't here, certainly nobody in this room, who told me off one time and said, you suggested Jesus had a sense of humour. I thought, well, besides looking in the mirror in the morning, that's... I said, yes, he did. But she said, but he was a man of sorrows. She's quoting Isaiah 53. I said, yes, he was. He took the sorrows of humanity upon him on the cross. But you don't invite someone who's totally miserable to your party. Who you can put in a guest? Oh, Jesus. Oh, no. I actually think there was comedy. I think this one, which related to his upbringing, he was a carpenter's son. And often when you were working with wood, you'd get sawdust in your eye and someone else would come along helpfully to remove the sawdust. It's not a negative image. But he said, but in the context of this, not judging, not condemning, forgiving, giving, he uses it and he says, look, if you're going to remove this little bit of sawdust that's getting in someone's eye and it's really irritating there and causing a problem, you need to take something. Yeah? You know, not only would, let's remind you, you might find it weird you get on the bus driver's like that. You walk on like this, good morning, trying to find your Ove chip card, trying to reach the Ove chip machine, because there's a plank in your eye. Jesus uses a very comical image to bring home an incredibly serious point. And he did that at times through his stories. Most people love stories. And Jesus tells a story. He draws the crowd in and then remove pin from hand grenade and gently drop it in. Jesus did that all the time. And I think he's doing that even with this image about remove the plank. You can do whatever you want with your rice grain, by the way. Keep it as a souvenir. Let's just pick up on this briefly before we then go to communion. You see, someone else in their life, there may be something in someone's life that actually it's helpful. It would be more helpful if it wasn't there in their lives. But we come along maybe in judgment and in condemnation and maybe with the wrong attitude and we take it as, I'm going to deal with that. But maybe we don't see perhaps prejudice in our own lives. We don't see an ability in our own lives to see what's going on in us. And so even though, yes, there is some sawdust in the eye, because Jesus says, remove the plank so that you can remove the sawdust from the other person's eye. He's not saying it shouldn't be removed. But he is saying, get rid of the plank. And maybe if we've got an attitude of prejudice or hatred or overgeneralizing or we're lacking love, perhaps what we've got is a plank, regardless of whatever it is that's going on in someone else's life. I think this is beautifully illustrated in the next chapter of Luke, Luke chapter 7, and you can read this in your own time. Let me just give you the verses as a reference point. It's verse 36 through to 50. Jesus has been invited to a meal at a house of a Pharisee called Simon. And there would have been guests who would also have been invited. But in the context culturally, even if you weren't invited to the meal, very often you could like walk in and watch what's going on. You could just see what was taking place. And most of the time, that's okay. And maybe for some of the wealthier, that was a way of showing off as well. Like, hey, look at the meal we're having, and you're not invited. That type of thing. But what happens on this occasion? Simon's there. He's maybe got his selected guests, and he's also invited Jesus, but as you will see, probably not on fair terms, which we'll come to in just a moment. And what happens? A woman bursts in. And a woman, as the text tells us, has a reputation around town for a sinful life. The text doesn't tell us exactly what it is. Many commentators think either she's probably a prostitute or at least certainly sexually loose. Simon's probably thinking, oh no. What are my guests going to think? Oh no, what's she doing here? Not only does she come in, she's weeping. Not only is she weeping, she gets down at the feet of Jesus. Jesus will probably be reclining on like a chair. And so she's down at the floor weeping and her tears wet his feet. Not only that, she unties her hair. Jewish women don't do that in public in that context. This is scandalous. And she wipes his feet with her hair. And then she takes this perfume and she anoints him. And listen to these words from the text, from verse 39. When Simon, who'd invited him, saw this, he said to himself, if this man were a prophet, he'd know who's touching him and what kind of woman she is, that she is a sinner. Jesus knew what he was thinking. He tells him a story. He says, there's two people who owe money to a moneylender. One of them owes 500 days' worth of wages. The other owes 50. And the moneylender forgives them both. He clears the debt. He says, which one will love the moneylender more? And Simon says, well, I guess the one who owed the more, the greater debt. And Jesus said, yes, you're right. And then text says, Jesus turned and he looked at the woman. And he says to Simon, do you see this woman? And Simon could go, of course I see this woman. But what did he see? He saw what he considered a dirty sinner. He considered someone who shouldn't be there. Maybe it was hitting his pride, hitting his spirituality, hitting his holiness, hitting his closeness to God. Because how dare this woman come in? He didn't see this woman. He didn't see her at all. But Jesus did. He saw her heart. He knew her life. But he saw her heart. He saw the repentant heart. He saw the pain and the sorrow. He saw the desire to connect with Christ. He saw the messiness of her journey. And it wasn't all clear cut. And he reached out to her. And he challenges Simon and says, Simon, when I came, you didn't give me water for my feet, which you should do for a guest. You didn't greet me with a kiss, which you should do for a guest. You didn't give me oil for my head. That actually the implication there is that Simon and his gang had invited Jesus, not on equal terms. What were they wanting to do? Sit him down and try and catch him out in some way? Seems to imply that in the text because he wasn't welcomed as a proper guest. And that he himself, who was not welcomed properly, reaches out to this woman who certainly wasn't welcome there
as far as Simon was concerned. Why? Because Simon was plank thinking. He had a whacking great big plank in his eye. This sinner, so much so that he couldn't see himself, was a sinner. Because he had his religion, but he didn't have God in the context there. He may have been a very God-fearing guy. He may have been very generous in other contexts, but in this aspect of his life, there was blindness. And we don't know what happened next. Hopefully, in the journey that, you know, his heart started to change. We don't know. The Gospels don't tell us. So he moved towards communion. Just three questions I want to put up. When we think about how we respond to one another, because this call for us to be accused of being a community that loves one another and love those around us, which at times has challenges to love, doesn't it? Is what I say from a place of love rather than judgment? Which links to what is my motive? If I'm going to go and seek to remove the speck of sawdust, because that's how it might be seen in God's heart, in someone else's life, why? Why? And is there a plank in my own eye? Is there hatred? Is there prejudice? Is there judgmentalism going on? And also, is that saying something right now appropriate? And should it be me saying it? So often, the church is seen by many people outside church world as being judgmental and moralizing and saying this is wrong and that's wrong and you need to change this. And if you do all that, maybe, just maybe, God might vaguely accept you. It gets in the way. Some of you have come across this before, I've put up, that so often this is how the church it seems to come across. We want you to behave. And if you behave, somewhere along the way, you'll believe. And if you believe, we'll let you belong. But you jolly well must keep behaving too. And that's how the message comes across. That following Jesus becomes a religion of behavior management. And that provided externally, we seem to be keeping a set of rules, then you're in. But if anyone is not keeping seemingly those set of rules, they're out. We've got to deal with that. We've got to put it right. This is how I'd rather be. It's how I'd rather ICL is. That we're a community where people can belong. Wherever they're at. Whether they believe in God or not. Whatever they think about different aspects of life, identity and so on, that they can belong. Now, sure, someone needs to come to know Jesus to be a follower of Jesus. Absolutely, to belong in that sense, need to know Christ. I'm not saying just because someone walks into a church service, it makes them a Christian. Of course it doesn't. You walk into your garage, if you've got one, you don't turn into a car. Silly example, but you know, it's... But to belong... And hopefully in that context, that creates a place where people can explore faith in a place of acceptance, in a place of safety, in a place of knowing they're not going to be judged and actually point people to Jesus. Because I don't know about you, when I reflect on the fact that I moved in 2006 to this country to be involved with this wonderful church, one of the reasons is I want to point people to Jesus. I don't want to come around being a moral policeman. I didn't move countries to be a moral policeman. And more importantly, Jesus did not die on the cross to set up a load of morality management. He died on the cross to bring us back to the Father and to reconcile us to one another. And in that process, if we come to know Jesus, that we... Oh, I got rid of it, didn't I? Sorry. That we come to know Jesus and we believe, then the journey begins. Let's use a Bible word for those who would like a Bible word. Sanctification. So when we come to know Christ, we are justified. We are made right with the Father. But then there is a journey begins. The Bible word is sanctification, of being made more like God. It's about God's holiness in our lives. It's about us becoming more like Jesus. That's why I use the word becoming. I don't use the word behave. In my marriage to Helen, it's not about behavior. If I do A, B, and C, and she does D, E, and F, there'll be X, Y, and Z. No, that's not relationship. That's weird. That's transaction. Search me, O Lord, and know my heart. Test me and know my thoughts. See if there is any anxious way in me, any offensive way in me, depending on translation. Lead me in the way everlasting. We're going to take communion together. Generosity, generous hearts. Love God. Love your neighbor as yourself. Remove the plank from your eye so you can help the other person and take the speck of sawdust out. Do not judge. You'll not be judged. Do not condemn. You'll not be condemned. Forgive and you'll be forgiven. Give and it will be given to you. Who said those words? The one who gave everything for us on the cross. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for you all. Lord, thank you for the words that you said, and they still, in that sense, live now to speak into our lives today. Lord, I thank you for everybody in this room. I thank you that you know each one of us, where our lives are at. Lord, if the people here would say they know you or not even sure that you exist, Lord, thank you that we are all welcome in your presence. Lord, as we go to take communion, remember what you did on the cross. Lord, thank you. Thank you that you gave your all. You didn't just give a percentage of yourself. Thank you, you died here for each person in this room. Thank you that you gave your life, taking the wrongdoing of humanity upon yourself. And that in you we can know forgiveness. In you we can know a fresh start. In you we can become followers of you, and with your Spirit's help, we can walk this challenging stuff out. We can know you're leading. Lord, thank you. Thank you for the cross, Lord. Amen.